Hello, I'm Robert Bound, and this is the Monocle Culture Show. We've got a musical episode this week, and I'll be joined by the journalists Liv Siddle and Sarah Carson as we give the new LP by Florence and the Machine a spin. It's called High as Hope and is the fourth album by the South London singer. Over the next half an hour, we'll be discussing musical styles and stories that make up this collection of songs and what they remind us of. Florence Welch soared to success after her debut album Lungs in 2009 stormed to the top of the charts. Her anthemic pop was everywhere. On the radio, on TV shows, film trailers, songs like Kiss with a Fist, Dog Days Are Over, and her cover of Candy Stanton's You've Got the Love. After this, two more albums followed, and Florence became known for her big voice over colossal Baroque pop tunes, as well as her romantic look, flowing floral dresses and long red locks. Florence is a born and bred South Londoner, having grown up in the artsy borough of Camberwell, and where she comes from is a big part of this new record, High as Hope. Now 31, she reflects on her teenagehood and 20s, fueled by parties and relationships, as she enters a new, more sober, perhaps, phase of her life. Sarah and Liv, welcome to the programme. And as we said in that intro, we all know what a Florence and the Machine song sounds like. Is everything present and correct on this new record?
I'd say so. I think it's definitely Florence. You can't really you can't really hear that voice and think it's anyone else.
When I first heard it, I was sort of concerned it might be a bit almost samey. It sounds so distinctively her, but actually there's a difference between sameness and a signature.
And sort of trademark.
Yeah.
And OK, before we kind of tackle the record head on, as reviewers and as experts, what's that like when you kind of just know it's the same? The voice is so recognisable, is so much a part of her thing. And I guess the production, the instruments that she uses and the way in which they're used, do you feel that people who have such a trademark sound kind of need to take it to bits sometime, or whether you can keep kind of striding forward?
I think it's nice as a listener to, you tend to miss your favourite artists when they go away and make an album. When they come back, I'm quite a creature of habit, so I quite like it when they sound as similar as possible to the last record, which is really boring. But it's nice. It's like a familiarity, and it's great when people take a kind of bit of a different route, maybe the Arctic Monkeys new album or something like that. But when you hear something that is like, oh, there she is, it's quite a nice feeling, and I like that.
Do you kind of listen more differently as a listener and as a reviewer? But there is maybe the kind of punter's kind of sense of familiarity and coziness with something, and then the reviewer kind of going, yeah, but I need something to say about it.
I think so, but I think that's where lyrics come in, isn't it? Like, you can kind of really pick apart the poetry of something a lot more easily in Florence's case, the orchestral and the harps and all of that kind of celestial sound is still there. It kind of makes it almost easier to go really deep into what she's actually saying. But certainly, I think it's comforting and familiar when somebody has their own thing, especially if they're able to break away from it without making too much of a statement. You know, some people decide that they're going to change genres altogether. Some people just decide to make subtle changes, which is almost more powerful.
I'm reminded of an interview from a long time ago, I think, when Radiohead were working on Kid A, and there was the pull quote in Q magazine that said, it was an interview with Tom York, and the pull quote was, well, we just really had it with Melody. And I was like, oh, I'm gonna hate this new record. And it is that sort of thing where you love people for being a strange version of something ordinary. And perhaps Florence is that thing. And part of, presumably, of cutting such a swathe through the mainstream is that familiarity, is knowing that that these songs can be produced fairly beautifully and bombastically live as well, right?
Yeah, you know you're going to go and see her again live this summer, and it's going to be great as always. That's kind of the reassurance that you want, as we kind of discussed a little bit before we came in here, as we always do before we come in. We talk about the things we should be talking about in here. We kind of discussed how people love seeing her live so much. You kind of, when you hear her album, you want to be assured of that you're going to see a great show. And I think that's really important. And she's definitely delivered that with this one, for sure.
The first track on the new album is, it starts softly with just with vocals and some soft piano. And I wondered if we were going to get something very different. How much has the sound changed, the way that these songs are put together? I quite like the fact it's quite a short album, only 10 tracks, Sarah. How far, if any further, has she brought this one on?
I would say that it's a lot subtler of an album. It's not all gung-ho. It's not every single instrument. There's quiet moments. There's restraint. I think she's a big flamboyant, or they are a big and flamboyant band, and certainly something that translates when they perform live. And you expect everything to be over the top. That's what you want as well. I don't think anybody's got bored of it. But it sort of feels a lot more meditative, which I like. She's always been thoughtful, but it's always been all of her emotions, often about relationships and love. This is slightly moved away from that, and it's given a lot of more meaty material about something different.
A lot of this album is written in the past tense, isn't it? It's about looking back on sort of relationships, more herself. It's not about certain guys or certain friends. Or, I mean, there's one that was written for Grace, her younger sister. There's one that's written about Patti Smith called Patricia, who are also people that she wants to address and say thank you to and sorry to in certain respects. But there is something that is a little bit more diary-like about this, where you kind of feel like you're looking over someone's shoulder as they write their thoughts down before they go to bed at night. In, I thought, quite an affecting and personal way.
Yeah, it's very diary, but I love that. I'm really, really into that. But I was thinking of, you know, these songs are, that there's such direct references to people that she knows, or people, you know, Patti Smith that maybe she does know, but it's kind of like odes to, and maybe we're going to spend the next few years trying to work out who these songs are actually about. But it's such a glimpse into her life, and it reminded me of this film that came out in 2000 by a documentary maker called Carol Morley, where she spent sort of 5 years of her life as an alcoholic and then tried to retrace her steps by interviewing people that she had met during that time. And I'm not saying that Florence Welch was an alcoholic, but she has talked about her sobriety now compared to her 20s, her mad, chaotic 20s. And it does feel to me that she's kind of retracing this past decade and just thinking, like, who was I meeting? What was I doing? And writing it down in this kind of, almost like a kind of travel diary of this decade, and then just really sort of, you know, apologising to people or romanticising these moments or just putting it all down on paper. And it's just fantastic because it's, you know, we all have a diary, don't we?
Yeah. And she writes very well about kind of being high and drunk and going to parties and being twirled round by Tom, Dick and Harry, and in a really romantic way. And we've all had nights like that. I thought she wrote about it really beautifully. There's something of escapism to that, and I guess kind of quite confessional.
I think it's one of the most easy to connect with records, not because I'm high and out being twirled around by Tom, Dick and Harry, but because everybody likes...
I said, or Harry.
Oh, well, your words, or my words, not yours, or whatever the expression is. So I think everybody likes that confessional type of record, or at least don't want to gender it, but I certainly think that a lot of women do connect with that kind of music better than other types, which can feel a bit detached. And I think here she's managed really well to write about being high and being out of control, perhaps, in a way that doesn't exactly romanticise it. She's done it romantically, but without trying to glamorise it, but also without being too navel-gazing. She hasn't tried to kind of act like some kind of lost soul and desperate for forgiveness. She's just kind of acknowledging a time in her life. All the songs to me, or a heavy number of the songs to me, seem to be written to herself without apology, but just kind of reflection, which I think is quite fresh. Not many people do that without getting a little bit too self-pitying, I think.
I understand that some of the tracks started off life as poems, and you might run a mile at the thought of that, thinking. But then listening to the record with that in the back of my mind, there's some really good writing, some good rhymes, and there's some really solid metaphors, and there's some lovely stuff in there. Something about wondering if it'll ever snow again, and a lot of references to New York. Some of it reminded me of Polly Harvey's Stories from the City, Stories from the Sea, which is such a beautiful, swooning record, where you can really imagine kind of sitting on the sort of tops of tall buildings, smoking cigarettes at 6 in the morning, as she talks about. And there is a kind of sense of that. There's a lot of kind of senses of sunrises that you're not necessarily meant to see in this record, which is kind of a difficult thing to do right without being a bit hello trees, hello sky about it, as you were saying, Sarah. It's a tough one to pull off.
I think so. I think she's managed to do it really well. She's said in quite a few interviews things like she felt in the past that you needed to be drunk to write a good song, or I'm paraphrasing that. that you needed to be in a really bad place to write good music. She's implied that that's how she once felt, but clearly here she seems quite stable and calm, but she's written music that manages to kind of capture chaos and discomfort and, you know, waking up and not knowing where you are and why you're there, but in a way that just doesn't feel like she's desperate for everyone to think that this is a great way to be, but also doesn't want pity.
In terms of the music, as you said, it's a little sparer. There's some really good drumming on it and things like that. I read that she has collaborated with Kamasi Washington, the man that's sort of kind of in control of a new kind of era of a kind of golden age of jazz, or sort of certainly one of the big names, and sort of unapologetically will whiz off on a 15-minute saxophone solo and stuff like that. Sampho, I think, has co-written or co-produced or works on some of these tracks. What about that? Did you hear any of that in this new LP?
I certainly didn't really hear Sampho. I think Jamie XX is on it as well. I didn't feel like that was overdone either. Kamasi Washington, I can kind of... You can sense an influence, but I, again, wouldn't say that it's desperately overt. But then I think perhaps that's a trend in music, to use people and not use them too much. Like, didn't Frank Ocean use Beyoncé and nobody really could tell that she was on that record, and a couple of others on that one too. So maybe that's just the new thing. Use them, but don't...
Personally, I kind of wanted to hear a bit more of that, because I thought it could. Those are the interesting avenues in which she could be pushed and flourish. But I wanted to hear her do something a bit more in that line, perhaps.
Yeah, I would. I would like to hear her do something. I like in like Beyoncé's Lemonade. I like how it's kind of like a spot Jack White. Oh, there he is. Like, it's quite obvious when the massive guitar solo comes in. Yeah. Oh, it sounds like Jack White. I would like it to be more apparent, because if I didn't know they were collaborating and working together, I probably wouldn't have picked it up. But then maybe that is good. Maybe you're right, that maybe that's the kind of way things are going, and maybe it doesn't need to be so obvious. You don't have to like put your brand onto someone else's brand and kind of do this kind of, you know, so-and-so X, so-and-so. It could just be this kind of lovely collaboration. But
be like Mick Jagger and David Bowie's Dancing in the Street,
But also for an album so personal, it's like... It probably shouldn't have those men's voices on it, because it's such a personal women's album. Maybe it would be weird to have it like, look, all these cool men. Like, it's about, it's so personal to her, and it's so intimate, and it's so about her life. It would be weird to have these randoms coming in.
I agree. Well, especially, I mean,
I'm already thinking of it as if it's a party.
Who are these guys? Get them out.
I feel like, to be fair, I kind of think if you're going to have them, use them, though. I mean, I acknowledge the trend, but I do sort of feel like if you're going to bother, you might as well make them known, because otherwise, what's the point? I mean, her sound is strong enough that she didn't need them in the first place anyway. Yeah. But I agree, it would be weird probably to have a load of blokes wading in, particularly since there isn't a huge male presence. It's not like this album seems to be written about one breakup, or it's just, it seems to be all about her and her influences and the people that she loves, but perhaps not romantically. So maybe, a testosterone-free zone.
I just wanted a bit of woozy, smoky saxophone to kind of sort of draw us in and out of certain tracks. But that's just me. That's just me. That's what we're doing around this table today. Aesthetically, Florence has always had something very pre-Raphaelite and very kind of out of step with the times a lot of the time, which has been maybe something why people have found her interesting, why she's been kind of an interesting role model and all the rest of it, and also why people have loved her live, because it's big, bombastic, bright, red hair, bang, amazing dresses and stuff. This is, they've got a very pared down kind of a visual aesthetic to it. It looks like she's kind of pretty unmade up. It's kind of, this is me. It looks very different. What do we read, if anything, into these visual tea leaves?
That is an excellent question. I think it's funny to have a visual brand, because, I mean, someone told me once, if you just keep wearing espadrilles, you will just come back and out of fashion. You just will. That's just the way things go.
David Hockney told you that.
So for Florence, you know, the flares thing and the pre-Raphaelite look, I think it was Eva Wiseman in the Observer magazine called her Lady of Shalott in blue jeans, which is like the perfect...
Pretty good.
The perfect name for her. But I suppose the aesthetic of the new album is trying to say something, but I don't want to comment too much, because I don't know how much record labels do liaise with artists. Sometimes they do. Sometimes the artist has full control over these things. Sometimes they don't. And I it's really hard to comment on whether that's like a
She'll have a lot of weight at Virgin, won't she? She's definitely kind of knows what she wants, I think, visually.
Yeah.
I would have thought. And I think it seemed to me quite a statement of, this is a new kind of chapter somehow. This is certainly a new record, and this is how I want to present myself in a slightly different way.
Yeah.
It seemed like that.
And if she's not using the whole like Mark Bolan / pre-Raphaelite vibe, then maybe she isn't hiding behind that anymore, and that's great. But she's just got that look. Like, she's always going to look like she's from like the 1400s or something.
In a good way.
Even if she had like a ponytail and stuff, she'd still look like it.
Yeah, like someone that maybe needed rescuing, or maybe was doing the rescuing of a damsel in distress.
Yeah.
Okay.
I guess some people could be accused of using their visual appearance and their signature look as a bit of a guise. It helps, I think, when you're starting out as an artist as well, to have a thing that people associate with you. But I actually feel like with Florence, everybody has called her this pre-Raphaelite beauty, you know, all of the flowing dresses and the platforms running around stage, hair flowing. But I kind of feel like those things, when you know when it's a guise, they get annoying. People just think, stop dressing up, let us see yourself. I don't think she's ever been annoying. I don't think anyone's ever felt that with her. But if she is deciding to chill out on that kind of aesthetic, then maybe it's speaking to the fact that this is a maybe more exposing record, or maybe she's just more mature. But I kind of feel like it would be quite a concerted effort to leave that behind, and I can't see her really changing properly, certainly not on stage.
I love it if for all of her live shows it was just her, maybe in espadrilles, dungarees, espadrilles, and just an upright piano, slightly out of tune, going, now look at me, now look what you've made me do, public.
The real me.
Yeah, exactly. Just in a pub in Camberwell as well.
It would be terrible.
That would be it. Yeah, exactly. Okay, some pretty rich pickings then, flowing off the back of High as Hope, new from Florence and the Machine. This is the bits of the programme, Liv, where I turn to you and go, what is our further reading, in inverted commas? What does it remind you of as a reviewer? What would be the CDs you would pluck from your shelf and go, it reminds me of this. I need to kind of remember track 5 of this, such and such. And you've mentioned Rufus Wainwright.
I have, but I got to him through a long string of others. I went through stages of thinking it reminded me of certain old Adele songs, and then certain songs by Laura Marling off the Short Movie album, and then certain songs by Joni Mitchell off Blue that were a bit like self-referential, like looking back over holidays and like Lovers Gone By and all this stuff. But Rufus Wainwright I decided on because, going back to kind of what I mentioned earlier about her addressing people in her past, that's like the Rufus Wainwright classic. It's just like, he's kind of apologising for being drunk, but also he's not that sorry about it. He's got all these things in his closet that he's kind of trying to get out with his songs. He just has this really frank way of speaking that kind of crushes you, and that's what a lot of her lyrics do on this album, to me anyway. They're just really heavy hitting, and then suddenly he'll just like take the next line and soar with it with that massive, amazing vocal range, and that's exactly what she does. So I just chose him because I can kind of imagine they've been to some similar parties as well, maybe along the lines. The kind of parties that maybe us peasants don't get to attend. These kind of like amazing, just like decadent parties that maybe they've realised over time have not been great for them potentially, and have changed their ways a bit. And I know that Rufus has done that, and now Florence has. So it was those similarities, but also just the songwriting, the kind of addressing people, and that kind of diary entry honesty that made me think about that. So
I love the idea of saying sorry to people, but not in so many words, and not being that sorry, but knowing that it's a trope that people, punters, might like on a record. Yeah. We've all done it without even writing a song, I'm sure. It's a good thought, isn't it?
Yeah, it reminded me of like High Fidelity, sort of going back and interviewing all your past lovers and being like, what did I do wrong? But also really not caring at the same time what they're saying. Yeah. It's that kind of, you know, slightly arrogant, slightly navel-gazing, but fantastic way of being. So that's why I chose him. And there are a few songs, I think, where that emotion comes through and the vocal range come through, which I think are particularly similar.
So which ones, for our listeners, can we point them in the direction of? Maybe they can flick back through their old record collection or go online. What do you lead them in the direction of? I know Oh What a World was something that you wanted to play a clip from.
Definitely Oh What a World. Also, anything off Want One or Want Two. And there's a song called Martha on a recent album of his, which is addressed to his sister as a kind of letter to her when their mother was dying. And it's just a very funny, witty, sweet song, but obviously crushing. And just his vocals just are amazing on that.
I can hear people scribbling this down on a piece of paper in their kitchen listening to this.
Well, they better bloody be scribbling it down.
Yeah, exactly. We've got the expert here, Liv Siddle. I wonder, in fact, actually, that with the new sound of this record and some of that, damaged erudition, you might call it. She'd been listening to a few Martha Wainwright songs herself. I adore her, and I felt there was that, as I say, that kind of, I don't know, damaged erudition, something about the pride of making it through, which was quite strong, quite affecting.
I don't know why I didn't pick Martha. Actually, Martha's a good comparison too. I think Martha Wainwright is as good a comparison to Florence's
new album. Let's change our minds live. Other Wainwrights are available, says Liv Siddle. Sarah, it was interesting. So when we first started talking about what we were going to talk about off the back of Higher's Hope, you were like, well, it seems quite sad. But actually, you changed your mind and you feel that there is a kind of steely optimism about this record, which I kind of like. I like the fact that obviously it changes its complexion as you listen to it, as you kind of go deeper into the music and the lyrics. Talk us through what Higher's Hope reminded you of and how it made you think.
Well, I suppose the main reason why at first I thought it was sad was that she has talked so much in interviews lately about emptiness and total chaos of her younger life, of her 20s, as we said before. And to me, when I first listened, I heard that sadness. I thought of all the other sad songs about breakups where she's managed to make them sound celebratory and jubilant that almost masks how tragic the actual lyrics are. But the more I listened to the lyrics and the more I sort of tried to pick them apart, I just thought, actually, there's something so reconciliatory about this album. It just feels like she is moving forwards. It's never really felt that she's been someone who you'd place as like in trouble, and she's not a, for want of a better comparison, an Amy Winehouse character where you have her eyes on, you think, oh God, she's such a party girl. But there's a difference between being an addict and liking a good night out and getting caught up in life on the London music scene, which obviously she's been really open about, and this record really goes into that. But yeah, as I was saying, I think she's managed really, really impressively to talk about really quite hard topics. She's talked about having an eating disorder in her teens on Hunger. She's talked about her grandmother's suicide on The End of Love. Just mentions. She doesn't go into them too much. She's talked, as we said before, loads about booze and pills on songs like South London Forever. She talks about that, and it is a wistful sounding song, but she doesn't glamorise it.
Is it like on that song that people will be listening to this all over the world and will be kind of having to Google the Joyner's Arms and Camberwell and stuff like that, which are name checked in that song.
Yeah.
And I kind of like that too. You know?
I love it. I love anything that places someone at the root, I guess, where they started. It's really nice when they mention these things. But yes, she's managed to talk about all these things in a way that acknowledges them. You know they're there. You know they've been going on. They're interesting things. They nod to, I'm reluctant to call her troubled. I have no idea whether she's troubled or not. But it nods to things going on that she hasn't opened up about, but she's managed to just sound so hopeful. She hasn't, nothing about the lyrics or the music has suggested real despair. Destruction and despair are not the same thing, and she is kind of acknowledging her responses to her life and to her sadnesses, but in a way that suggests that the future's bright. You know, you can be calm, that's not going to make you happy. She said, I think on, it may be the last song on the record, happiness is an extremely uneventful subject. And that I thought was really interesting because it's like saying, oh, you know, she's not necessarily writing about her life now. She's writing about everything else when she wasn't happy, and now she's trying really hard. And the album closes and opens with that, with sort of choirs and references to choruses. And I don't know, they're there through the sadness at the start and the kind of happiness of going forward.
And that's exactly kind of how I felt about it, that it's tough to, as you say, happiness can be a dead-end subject when it comes to writing tunes, anything that rhymes, anything that's good. I mean, everyone thinks you're cloying and awful. If you kind of write a simple love song or something rather than kind of going, well, look where I am now, it's not exactly great kind of fodder for stuff. And I don't think she kind of overplays her troubledness. I think she kind of has a tongue-in-cheek look back in it and kind of has risen above it. And the choruses and the chords and the choirs and all those soaring bits of instrumentation kind of take you somewhere else. So finally, let's talk about that. Let's talk about the live offering. She'll be doing festivals. I think she will. I mean, I think she's kind of tried to, always trying to do a bit less of that the next couple of years or so. But this will be, you would have thought, a well-supported record in terms of live stuff. Are we looking forward to seeing Florence and the Machine playing some of this, at least live, this summer?
I'd like to see her in a non-festival capacity.
Well, you've got the fans fans for her in a venue.
Yeah, I think so. I don't know why. I think for this record, I'd like to see it in non-festival. But then I would like to see it at a festival because it's just, you know, it's just going to be so fun, isn't it? It's just going to be like party time.
Yeah.
Her like jumping around on stage. Maybe not so much in this record, actually. I don't know. I think she's always great to see.
It's quite tough for her not to do that. I think it's a tough thing. Especially she often seems to be booked at festivals. She stood in at the end. Who did she stand in for at Glastonbury and did an amazing set? Ended up headlining it in lieu of was it Coldplay?
I think it was the Foo Fighters.
Oh, was it the Foo Fighters? And was great. It's kind of, she gets lent on a lot. I saw her supporting the Rolling Stones a couple of weeks ago and she was wonderful. And it's one of those things, I think, the night before Liam Gallagher had done it and was not particularly well loved. And people dug her, you know, and she duetted on Wild Horses with Mick Jagger and stuff and it was wonderful. But she gets lent on a lot to be great live. I know what you mean. I'd like to go to somewhere where it's just people that know the words and singing them back at her, that not just to Dog Days Are Over or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah, just to go for her lyrics and her performance and her as a person rather than just like, oh, this will be a laugh.
Yeah.
I think she likes to perform. I think she likes giving the audience a good time. And I think a lot of her own pleasure comes from that. And I think, as you mentioned earlier, she has been sort of talking about how now she can go on stage sober, which before she couldn't do. And that's going to be different for all of us, isn't it? Because we don't know what it's been like. But that's going to be great. And it's probably going to be better.
As long as I'm holding my hand as an audience member, I'm going to be fine.
I think it's going to be a new experience for sure. But definitely one to look forward to.
Sarah, after the World Cup's been on in the pub and then they've put Love Island on, would she come a week third for you on a night out?
It depends on the venue. In a pub, after the World Cup and Love Island, I mean, it would be quite a joy. I don't know. I can't see her suited to an open mic night, to be honest. I like that she's a festival person. I think it must be kind of annoying to be so often talked about as a festival. Like, everybody's seen her at a festival. Perhaps she'd rather she was someone who was known for doing big dates and small venues. I don't know. Artists always seem to love small venues, and maybe she really revels in this huge collective euphoria that comes from doing You've Got the Love with that many people. And there are some bangers on this record, actually, because something like, I feel like Hunger could be brilliant with a huge crowd, or Sky Full of Song, I think that's another really big song. So I think it could work, but maybe it would be great to see her in a small venue, just her forced to be exposed, and with this album, her most exposing yet.
Espadrilles and the standard and the upright piano.
Perhaps.
In a pub in Camberwell.
Yeah,
it can be arranged. brilliant. Thank you so much, both, for coming in to talk through High as Hope by Florence and the Machine, which is out now on Virgin Records. Thank you, as I said, to my guests today, Sarah Carson and Liv Siddle, and to my producers, Holly Fisher and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Join us next week, where we'll be discussing the fashion documentary McQueen. But until then, from me, Robert Bound, thank you very much for tuning in. Thank you.